Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money. Today is August 11th. I'm Roger Goldman, your host. I'm here with my co-host, Kevin Kennedy. Morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Roger. How are you feeling today?
Well, I got a bit of the flu, but we're going to battle through because we have some really interesting people to talk to this morning.
Absolutely.
We're going to start our hour by speaking with author Evan Osnos about his new book, The Have and Have Yachts, a book about the indulgences, incentives, and psychological distortions that define our economic age.
And then we'll speak with the economist Corey Husak of the Center for American Progress and dive into some tax talk surrounding the latest big, beautiful bill. All this and more this morning on Mountain Money. Stay tuned.
We live in a world where the ultra-rich are indeed ultra-rich. In 1960, there were fewer than 10 billionaires in the U.S. Today, there are more than 800. The lives of the super-rich are different. Author Evan Osnos allows us to peek into their world in his new book, The Have and Have Yachts. We are lucky to be joined by him this morning. Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money.
Thanks, Roger. Great to be with you guys.
I will try to get that landline to go away. Evan, let's start. What motivated you to write the book, and how long did it take to do the research?
Well, gosh, it started actually about a decade ago in unusual circumstances. I was on a plane, and I started chatting with the guy next to me, which I don't always do, by the way, but, you know, because you never know how that's going to go. But it turned out to be kind of fascinating. He works in Silicon Valley. And I said, so, you know, what's a story that you don't think is getting enough attention that's interesting? And he said, well, have you written about the Plan B guys? And I said, what are the Plan B guys? And he said, these are people who are preparing for the end of the world. And that got me launched on this because it made me realize there is a whole realm of activity and spending and thinking about wealth and power that really is beyond our view. And that took me off to New Zealand for research on that topic, and then eventually all around. And that was the beginning of a process that led to this book.
Nice.
As you read the, and I we should explain, the book is a series of essays on different topics. Were these published as individual articles over time? And it's a lot of, I could tell as you read the book, I could tell that you sort of wide-eyed, sort of looking around and going, gosh, this is kind of unbelievable and really cool. Have I got that
yeah.
right?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It was a little bit like, you know, seeing a little bit of thread sticking out under the rug and starting to pull that thread and realizing, oh my gosh, there is an entire world, a whole tapestry of taste and competition and anxiety and ultimately power that you could begin to see in the form of these really kind of odd, jaw-dropping demonstrations if you just figured out where to look and could get enough people to talk to me.
So now the book starts off aptly about yachts. The Palm Beach International Boat Show.
Exactly. Yeah, good
now,
memory, Kevin.
A lot of us around here are used to reservoirs and little outboards. Can you describe some of these yachts that were at the boat show? The boat show.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like the word boat doesn't quite encompass it because to put it in perspective, there's always been yachts going back for a few hundred years. But I mean, as recently as 100 years ago, the old saying was that your yacht should only be as long in feet as you are in years. So if you were my age, 48, you should have a 48-foot boat. Well, these days there are 438-foot yachts, for instance.
Wow.
The one owned by the Saudi Crown Prince. Yeah, and you know, these are the most expensive objects that our species has ever figured out how to own. And I mean that very specifically. That's not an exaggeration. It's more expensive than the most expensive piece of real estate in the United States, the most valuable piece of art that's ever been purchased. That was, just to remind folks, it was Leonardo's Salvador Mundi painting, which, by the way, now hangs on the wall of a yacht, which belongs to the Saudi Crown Prince. So these things became symbols in my mind of an era. And I said, I want to learn everything I possibly can about these yachts and what they mean for the rest of us.
I enjoy. Oops, sorry, Roger. Go ahead,
Kevin.
Well, I like to
talk a little bit about what life on board these yachts is like.
I think you're having the experience that I had, which is, wait a second, I got so many questions. I felt like So I'll tell. Here's the most amazing fact about these yachts, which is that the law, which is the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, this was a law that was passed after the sinking of the Titanic, means that on these yachts you can only have, with very rare exceptions, 12 guests spend the night, because otherwise you have to begin to put in all the safety gear more like a cruise ship. However, you can have an unlimited number of crew members attending to those guests. And so as one yacht owner said to me, he said, really, it's a ratio that you can't get anywhere on land, by which he meant for each individual guest, you might have 3 or 4 or 5 people attending to them, 50, 60 members of the yacht crew. So it's frankly, it is a world that looks a lot more like Downton Abbey than it does like the world that the rest of humanity is inhabiting these days.
Now, why are the owners willing to spend so much in the race to have the biggest yacht?
I think when you really boil it down, Kevin, I've spent a lot of time thinking about talking to a lot of yacht owners, and it comes down to something that is as familiar to us as the middle school lunchroom, which is about, you know, who has the newest sneakers, the coolest backpack. It just doesn't change when you add another 8 or 9 zeros to it. I mean, I'm not kidding. I had stories of a yacht captain told me about once when he was going around with the owner of the yacht he worked on, and you know, he had spent a couple of $100 million on his yacht, but they were cruising around the Mediterranean and they began to see much bigger, more beautiful yachts in the harbor. And finally the owner said, you know, take me back to my boat, because this is, I don't know how I can keep up with this. And so there's a term that psychologists use called hedonic treadmill, the idea that whatever gives us satisfaction, you know, what is the most hedonistic thing on a Monday? If you have it every day, by Friday, you're frankly kind of used to it and sick of it. And so that happens. No matter how luxurious this object is, sooner or later, you want another one or a bigger one.
Yeah. Now, I think at the boat show, you mentioned a 250-foot yacht. What, since we're a show about money, what does that cost per day to operate? Fuel, crew? It's got to be
great question.
6 figures.
It is. The numbers on this are quite reliable. So for a 250, let's call it a $250 million vessel, because that's actually the operative fact for what we're talking about. It'll cost you 10% per year to operate. So $25 million per year, about $2 million a month. And that's just to keep it from sinking to the bottom of the ocean and keeping it staffed. So this is the puzzle. You know, the Financial Times had a great column where they were describing yachts, and they said, the headline was pretty clear. The headline was, a yacht is a terrible investment. And now, then they called it, they said it's the equivalent of holding 10 Van Goghs above your head while treading water. And here's the thing. The guys who buy them, I've talked to a lot of folks about the decisions they make around the financing. And they say, I'm not buying this because I must. I'm buying this because I can. It is a choice about pleasure and leisure. And frankly, it's a choice also about, you know, peacocking around your buddies and showing that you can do it. So for them, money is not a constraint. Money is, in fact, kind of the point.
We could probably spend this entire half hour on yachts. And both Kevin and I would enjoy that. But let's try to move on. Earlier, as we went into the introduction, and you said what first sent you down this path was this notion of these survivalists. You describe a world in which some of the ultra-rich have planned to survive a breakdown in society. Can you talk a little bit about the Survival Condo Project, which I thought was fascinating?
Yeah, this is an interesting place. It is at an undisclosed location beneath the prairie in Kansas. And I got to talking to the developer, and I said, here's what I'm writing about it. This is a place where for about $3 million or so, you can buy an underground bunker inside a nuclear-hardened, decommissioned missile silo from the Cold War. And it's not exactly Spartan conditions. I mean, they have walls that are now fitted out with windows that are, in fact, LED. They are screens, and you can program them to look like any vista you want. So if you want to see, you know, the gore, if you want to see Park City, you can have your screens showing you Park City. If you want Central Park, you can do that. Now, it's a little bit like any high-end real estate. And I'll tell you one funny thing that I didn't put in the book, but is kind of recognizable perhaps to many of us, which is like any high-end real estate, there's a little bit of drama. And so one of the occupants, one of the bunker buyers, he wanted it to look like Bermuda, where he spends the rest of the year. So he painted it in all these really bright island colors. But it turns out when you're underground and it's a small space, that's kind of oppressive. And so the others complained, and he had to have his decorator come in and fix it. But, you know, look, why am I writing about this? I'm joking about it, but it is also, it gives us a window into a period of our thinking about how people, some of whom have actually succeeded in America by anticipating, looking around corners, seeing where things are moving, and they are uneasy. They feel as if the public mood is quite fragile. They feel as if they're not sure about social cohesion. And that's why these bunkers, like these yachts, they're sort of symbols of a period of anxiety. And I think that's what I wanted to dig into, talking to them about it and what makes them feel that way.
Now, would you, I imagine most of their money is not sitting in cash. I mean, $250 million is sitting in a yacht. They've got this condo. And if the so-called end of the world shows up, do they actually think they're going to have any money?
Yeah, it's a great question. Kevin, I talked to them about that. A lot of them practice a portfolio approach to their assets, where they keep some of it overseas. They keep some of it in crypto, some of it in gold, some of it in art. I was talking to a wealth manager in New Zealand who says, oh yeah, I know folks who have boats floating around in the Pacific that are essentially just floating warehouses of value, and they stock them with things that could be useful to them in the event of chaos in the currency markets. Now, I think you have to stop at the point this in the conversation and say, all right, how much of this is rational and how much of this is nuts? That's always hard to separate. Now, there is a level. I came out of this research thinking to myself, you know, I came home and said to my wife, you know, yeah, I don't know. Should we really be totally so heavily invested in American securities? Maybe there's something else we should be doing. But the net takeaway from my perspective was that that there is now a level of wealth that is, frankly, even beyond the normal growth of previous decades in the 20th century. We entered a period of hypergrowth of wealth at the very top, starting in the late 70s, early 80s, and we're living through it now. Just to put a fine point on it, 10 years ago, let's remind ourselves, there was nobody in the world who had more than $100 billion. There were no centibillionaires. There are now at least 15 of them. The richest, of course, is Elon Musk. He had $10 billion a decade ago. He now has more than $400 billion. And as a couple of analysts said to me in my research, they said, look, it's simply the case that our institutions, our laws, our culture, even our psychology has not evolved fast enough to absorb and accommodate all of this rapid growth in wealth. And so that's where you start to see some of these kind of more spectacular expressions and collisions of it.
My favorite chapter was the one on booking rock stars for private concerts. Are people really paying hundreds of thousands of dollars for the most elaborate bar mitzvah?
Oh yeah, I could tell you, because I had the very memorable experience of embedding with the hip hop star Flo Rida for a bar mitzvah in Chicago. He gets about $250,000 for a bar mitzvah or a sweet 16. He does, according to his lawyer and according to Flo Rida himself, he does two dozen of these a year in the U.S. He gets $1 million overseas when he travels. I mean, he's done. And look, it's not just him. This is what's fascinating about it, Roger, is it used to be that it was kind of, I'll be blunt, it used to be kind of washed up crooners who used to do these private gigs. And as an agent at a major agency said to me, I used to get calls where people would say, is there anybody in your catalog who does private gigs? He says, now I tell them, just look at the catalog, because almost anybody will do it. And the reason for that is that the economy around culture, about being a performer, has changed dramatically in the streaming era. So they don't make as much money as they did when they got CD sales. So now they get a fraction of a penny for every time it streams on Spotify. So they've, in a way, it's almost like a return to the old days of performing. And there are only a couple people who you can't get on private gigs. It is... From every agent I've talked to, the answer is you really can't get Bruce Springsteen, you can't get Taylor Swift, and for reasons that nobody could explain to me, you can't get AC/DC.
But you could get The Who.
Oh, you could definitely get The Who. Actually, that's, I think, in some cases, actually big acts, the ones that we think of as iconic acts of the 60s and 70s, they are doing a lot of this kind of private work. As one drummer said, I mean, the Rolling Stones, you can go down the list, Paul McCartney. As one drummer who does a lot of these private gigs said to me, it used to be that there was nobody out in the world who could afford to have the Foo Fighters in their backyard on a Tuesday. And now there are. And so that's why this economy exists.
Jeez. Now, commentators have mused about how strange the takeover of the Republican Party was. How did what happened in Greenwich help to explain things?
Yeah, it's an interesting case study. I grew up in Greenwich, Connecticut, you know, suburb of New York City, prosperous place, always has been. And what's fascinating was when I was a kid growing up, you know, this was the heartland, like the really the laboratory of what we used to call the country club Republican. And that's, I can give you even a face to the name, which is the father of George H.W. Bush, grandfather of George W. Bush, was a guy named Prescott Bush, who was from Greenwich, Connecticut. He was the, you know, ran the town council. Then he became the senator from Connecticut. And he was the town club golf champion. He was also like the iconic centrist Republican. He was Eisenhower's golf partner. He was the guy who said, you know, we need to pay more taxes in some cases to pay for education and health care. And over time, I saw this begin to change to the point that in 2016, what really caught my eye was that even as Prescott Bush's great-grandson was running for president, Jeb Bush, the head of the local Republican town committee, came out in favor of Donald Trump. And that was a real sign. And I spoke to him at length. I remember Jim Campbell, who was the head of the town committee at the time. He said, look, the truth is, everybody's saying the same thing. They said, this guy says everything I think. And I think that that process, the process of going from a Republican Party dominated by the figures like George H.W. Bush to being dominated by the ideas and the person of Donald Trump, tells you a big story about America and about how we think about ideas like success and competition and greed and dominance and all these big ideas that are competing in our consciousness. They've been kind of reformulated. And if you study the place that I grew up, you know, which is, it's in my bones, you know, my family's been there a long time. I can understand how it happened. And it's a story I tell in the book.
Yeah. The chapter on Zach Horowitz, which, you know, sort of leaped out to me and had me think about Bernie Madoff. It kind of reads like the plot of a Scorsese movie. Can you share a bit about his story and what it tells us about greed?
Yeah. Your instincts are right, Roger, by the way. Zach Horowitz's favorite movie is The Wolf of Wall Street. I'll tell you that this story is, this one kind of just knocked me flat. I was amazed by it. There's a young man growing up in Indiana who has an idea, kind of dream of going to Hollywood someday. And he tells his buddies that he's got this extraordinary good fortune. He happened to meet Howard Schultz, you know, the CEO, the coffee tycoon. And Howard Schultz offered him a job, as he told his friends. And he was helping to scout out new investors and so on. And so he goes off to Hollywood. And anyway, long story short, I'm not going to give it all away, other than to say, he never met Howard Schultz. Howard Schultz has never heard of Zach Horowitz. And yet Zach Horowitz managed to hoover up the largest Ponzi scheme in Hollywood history, $750 million, which included him getting on screen with all kinds of big actors like Brian Cox, the father in Succession. He was in a movie directed by Ralph Fiennes. I mean, it is a hell of a story. And he kind of unspooled it for me sitting there in a jail cell. I better not say any more, or I'll give away all the fun stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Now, you paint a picture, a fascinating picture of a white-collar support group of convicted criminals. What did you learn about the way these people regarded their criminal activity, and how did they see their lives after prison?
You know, that one was a pretty interesting experience, and it ties in some ways to Roger's question about the story of Zach Horowitz, which is at the core of this is the big issue. It's almost an issue as old as the Old Testament. It's greed. It's greed. And I heard it over and over from folks who had been down the path. They'd gotten as high up into the stratosphere as they could, and then they'd taken the big fall. And what they would tell me was that at a certain point, they lost sight of what the boundaries around decent behavior were. And they began to lie to the people around them. And it made sense at the time. You know, there was a fascinating quote from a really admired figure who some folks will remember, named John Bogle. He was the innovator of the modern mutual fund, passed away a few years ago. And he said, you know, when I got into my business 6 decades ago, there were things that you simply didn't do because it felt wrong. He said, it feels to me nowadays in so much of our lives that if other people are doing it, we feel like we can do it too. And that idea, which I think we all recognize in one form or another in our culture, it can lead into some pretty tragic places in people's lives. And I came to know a guy who had started a, if you can believe it, a white-collar support group. This is a group of guys in my hometown in Greenwich, Connecticut, and elsewhere around the country, who had gone to prison for white-collar crimes, come back out, and were trying to, as the founder of it put it to me, he himself had gone to prison. He said, you know, this is about guys detoxing from power and influence. And it became almost a laboratory for understanding some of the bigger issues in our societies. And, you know, how do we come to believe that what we're doing is right and decent in cases where we're actually taking advantage of people? And a lot of fascinating stories of people wearing wires, about being betrayed, betraying others, but ultimately coming to learn some pretty deep insights about how to live in our society.
Well, you can see why they would do that. I mean, you're cruising around the harbor in your $200 million yacht, and you see a $300 million yacht. You go, oh, I want that. I think I can lie my way into that.
Well, that's it. I think that's a piece of it. You know, we're surrounded by the indicators. The society is kind of quietly whispering in our ears, you know, a little more, a little more, a little more.
You know, there's a wonderful sequence in The Smartest People in the Room about Ken Lay. As things are starting to fall apart, Ken Lay calls a meeting to redecorate the jet.
Yes.
I spent some time in my prior life. I was a white collar defense lawyer, and I've seen people delude themselves. You know, everything's crashing and they're worried about other things. But we could get into that much more. Before we go, and by the way, I want to say about this book, and for those of us who've listened, you could tell that the author clearly was having an excellent time learning about all this stuff. And it comes through in the book, and you get to share it, and it's delightful. Let's go to the bottom line. What do you want the reader to come away with in terms of the societal impact of the ultra wealthy? What are we trying to learn here?
I think that what really hit home for me, the longer I worked on this, was that it's very easy for us to look around and say, you know, maybe this is all within the normal parameters of history. You know, we've always had the pendulum swinging one way or the other, and we've had the growth of great fortunes, and then they go away for a while. We've actually entered into new territory now. The sheer scale of money that is actually even, frankly, there are more piles of great wealth in our society than even the public is usually aware of. And that is both a marvelous thing, because it is a sign of our innovative capacity in this country. It's a sign of some of the things that we've been able to build. But it's also a bit of an alarm bell for us. We've been down this road at the end of the 19th century. We made choices. Some of our most successful entrepreneurs said, you know what? I'm going to start to throw some more tomatoes into the soup here. People like Andrew Carnegie, John D. Rockefeller. And they made sure that we had, by giving back, by making choices to protect some of their communities, they actually laid the foundation for the most successful century in human history, the 20th century, the American century. And I think if we make some smart choices now, we can do the same thing for the 21st century.
Like, who needs $250 million yacht? I'd be so happy with a $150 million yacht. If anyone has one, they want to...
tightening our belts, Kevin. We'll make do with $150.
Exactly. You could see a lot. Well, wonderful. Roger, up to you.
Okay, the book is To Have and Have the Haves and Have Yachts, Dispatches on the Ultra Rich. When spending time this morning with Evan Osnos, the author, thanks so much for spending time with us.
My pleasure, guys. Great to be with you.
All right, we'll be right back after this.
Well, last week on Mountain Money, we spoke with libertarian economist Dan Mitchell about some of the economic implications of the so-called Big Beautiful Bill.
As part of our Both Sides Now series, today we are joined by economist Corey Husak, Director of Tax Policy at the Center for American Progress, to give his perspective on some of those same implications. Corey, let's start by summarizing the major portions of the bill as they affect the economy.
Yeah, no, happy to. And thanks for having me on. On the simplest level, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act does two things. And I want to just, lay those out because I think they're the most important things for your audience to take away. So first, it transfers $1 trillion from poor Americans to the richest Americans. It does this by canceling about $1 trillion in spending on Medicaid and SNAP food assistance and giving $1 trillion in tax cuts to the richest 1%. So, your average member of the top 1% is getting a tax cut of about $68,000 per person. And, we're cutting, approximately 20% of our spending on, SNAP food assistance and Medicaid for the poorest Americans. So that's the first thing it does. The second thing is, in this sort of what this one budget hawk group called a dark day for our fiscal future, it increases the debt by $4 to $5 trillion. Now, $4 to $5 trillion, that could be hard to visualize. What does that mean? This is a larger deficit impact than all the major bills we passed since COVID. So to be specific, this bill increases the deficit by more than the March 2020 CARES Act. That was what, sent, with the Congress passed right before COVID hit and, sent us all into sort of lockdown. It's larger than that. It is larger than the big bill, the American Rescue Plan that Biden passed when he first came into office, sending out some more checks and, doing other things to, restart the economy. It is bigger than the infrastructure investment law that we passed a few years ago. It is bigger than the CHIPS and Science Act. It is bigger than all four of those bills combined. And it will have a larger deficit impact than all four of those bills combined, according to, the Congressional Budget Office, according to other nonpartisan scorers. So, I think we're going to unpack both of those two things, but I think the two most important facts about the bill is it is a $1 trillion transfer from poor Americans to rich Americans. And, and also it is the biggest deficit buster we've seen in quite some time.
Now, keeping things nonpartisan, so saying that it goes from wealthy Americans to, from poor Americans to wealthy Americans, is that a fact or an opinion?
That is a fact. I will, I don't want to, be peppering in anything that's, not backed up by the data here. But, we can, and so, when I'm talking about some of these figures, I'll be citing, I'm mostly talking about what the Congressional Budget Office is saying. That's Congress's, nonpartisan budget scorer. That's who, we kind of look to in Washington for some of these. There's lots of groups that do scores of things. But, in general, so we're hoping this week to get an update to this score. But the most recent score that we have from the Congressional Budget Office says that the bottom 30% of Americans are going to be worse off. They're going to lose money because of this bill. And the Congressional Budget Office's tax arm estimates that about $1 trillion, that $68,000 per person, is going to the top 1%. So, you put those two things together. The Congressional Budget Office says that, just under $1 trillion of Medicaid is being cut. A couple hundred $100 billion of SNAP food assistance are being cut. That goes from, those programs are squarely targeted at the poorest Americans. So, I'm just relaying the numbers from the Congressional Budget Office. We are taking, over $1 trillion from the poorest Americans, and we are giving it to the top 1%.
Yeah, well, we just had Evan Osnos on, and we understand why they have to upgrade their $200 million yacht. So, you know, that's that's kind of going there. So now the CBO contends that the bill will add $3.4 trillion to the deficit over the next 10 years, largely due to a $4.5 trillion reduction in revenue. Kevin Hassett, the head of Trump's Economic Council, argues that the bill will essentially pay for itself due to growth. Can you explain the theory behind the that in the Laffer curve?
Yeah. You know, there are some theories there, and certainly yes, if you're right, if you listen to the White House, they will say that the tax cuts will produce so much economic growth that supposedly revenue is going to go up because of this. And you know, we've sort of seen this movie before. They said the same thing 8 years ago when they passed their first set of tax cuts. And you know, we have evidence from those tax cuts that this just doesn't happen in any meaningful way. And you know, I don't want to be too equivocal about this, but just about anyone who's not on the payroll of the White House or looking to get on their payroll believes this. You know, I think there's widespread nonpartisan agreement that this bill is a big budget buster from you know, conservative economists, from liberal economists. And you know, to kind of break it down, you know, people who try to say otherwise, they're a bit like the story of the confused business owner whose business partner comes to them saying, you know, sir, our prices are too low. We're losing money on every product that we sell. And he responds, oh no, don't worry. We'll make it up by selling more product. I'm like, no, that just drives you deeper into the hole. And you know, that's a bit like what the federal government's doing right now. We have wide and growing deficits, and Congress just tried to solve that problem by cutting how much we tax you know, Americans as a whole, but you know, the richest Americans especially. And they're cutting that below a sustainable level. And you know, we're kind of like that businessman. His partner comes to him and says, you know, our prices are too low. And he says, okay, cut the prices even more. And, you know, it's just going to keep driving us into the hole here. There's some intuition just to, you know, to take the Laffer curve seriously for a moment. You know, sometimes, you know, it is theoretically possible for taxes to be above the level where they're effective at collecting revenue. This basically doesn't exist in the U.S. today, except for, you know, tobacco taxes are maybe a special case, and some of the tariff levels now are probably going to be above the optimal revenue collection levels. And, you know, the idea is that if you have one tax rate for the whole economy and you cut that tax rate, it's at 90%, you cut it down to 75%, and then, you know, the economy might grow in response because, you know, new activities become profitable that weren't before. And, you know, the math on this kind of checks out. If you're in that situation, then you may end up getting more revenue than you had before. But crucially, it's because you're still taxing people at a fairly high level. And if you're only taxing people, if you're taxing people at 75%, you really only need the economy to grow by $1.33 for every dollar that you cut. But this sort of breaks down when you get to current levels of taxation in the economy. So our corporate rate is at about 20% right now. And in order for the government to make money collecting or by cutting corporate taxes like they did back in 2017, for every $1 that you cut, you would have to turn that, corporations would have to turn that $1 into $5, because we only get 20% of each marginal dollar that increases. So if we cut taxes by a dollar and then only cut or then only collect taxes on 20% of the created dollars, you really have to believe in this astronomical ability of corporations. They have all this free money sitting around. They can turn $1 into $5. And that's just not something that we find when we look at the evidence throughout the economy right now. When you look at the evidence for previous tax cuts, when you look at projections for what this tax cut's going to do.
I do want to talk a little bit about history, because when I brought up this topic to some friends of mine, they look at me and go, well, of course cutting rates increases growth and pays for itself, as if I am completely from planet Mars. So let's talk a little bit about that. What can we learn from either the Bush tax cuts or the 2017 tax cuts? What does history tell us factually about whether these things work?
Yeah. So, you know, Sometimes I get, like, you know, I was actually fairly surprised. I'm, you know, more skeptical on the side of tax cuts paying for themselves, I think within, you know, within the U.S. But, you know, even I thought, you know, in 2017, we cut the corporate rate by a lot, you know, that we're going to see some effects. And like right now, you and I are going to be arguing about, well, you know, was it, you know, 50 cents on the dollar? Was it 25 cents on the dollar? When they first cut the taxes in 2017, you could not tell to any reasonable approximation that there was any more investment by corporations in the economy in 2018 and 2019 than there had been previously in 2016 and 2017. Just looking at the 2 years on either side of the tax cut, you know, a learned observer could not dig through the data and find any sort of like upward trend. And that was very surprising to me. There was, you know, just nothing pointing to the fact that this was having an effect on growth and output. You know, since then, we've had, you know, very careful economists, you know, big teams of economists from Treasury, from the Joint Committee on Taxation at the Congressional Budget Office, you know, combing through corporate tax returns, comparing corporations that had more of their taxes cut than less cut. And they do find that, you know, the corporate tax cuts did raise growth by a little bit, and that the amount of growth that was raised paid for about 13 cents on the dollar for every dollar that was cut. So, you know, that there were small impacts on growth, and, you know, essentially they turned every dollar cut into about $1.10 in extra, you know, economic activity. So, you know, it is not untrue that cutting corporate rates raises economic growth, but these effects are really, really small. And, you know, you can see them if you are a trained economist doing a careful study, but otherwise, you know, you're not really going to see them. And I should add, you know, even when we do see these corporate tax rates produce growth, that same study found, you know, they also looked, okay, where did the growth go? Like who benefited from, you know, that extra, you know, those tax cuts, that extra economic activity? Did corporations pass it on to their workers? Did, you know, it really, you know, did they pass it on to consumers by lowering prices because their profits are up? And they find that over half of the gains went to firm owners. Another 10% went to firm executives, and then the remainder went to highly paid workers at the firm. 0% of the extra growth went to low paid workers at those firms. So, you know, even this study, you know, basically the most careful one that I've seen going through private confidential tax data to find these answers, finds that 0% of the gains go to low paid workers. Most of it goes to the owners and the executives.
If you go further back, were there studies that looked at the Bush tax cuts? Because I know, you know, we had sort of coming into the Bush administration, I think we were actually running a surplus, right, and under Clinton. Yep. Bush comes in, cuts the taxes, and obviously other things happen like 9/11. But what do we learn about the impact of the Bush tax cuts?
Yeah, you know, I think there's several. The Bush tax cuts, the only time we've had, you know, a bigger deficit impact on the economy than this bill was, you know, the Bush tax cuts, you know, depending on how, if you take them as a series or as a single bill. So they were quite large, and they had really varied, you know, impacts on the economy. I think, you know, on the specific topic of the business tax cuts in there, there was a dividend tax cut that, you know, it used to be you paid, you know, your full income tax on dividends, and now they're taxed at the capital gains rate because of that. There's a really careful paper that, you know, I also really, really enjoyed that compares, you know, the companies that got that dividend tax cut to the companies that did not, and, you know, traces them over years and years to try and see what happened to investment, what happened to wages, what happened to the number of workers. This finds that the corporations that got their dividend tax cut did not increase employee compensation, did not increase investment. They solely passed that along to shareholders. And it's a bit of a sobering finding. And, I think when I say that, this is not the place to look for, for growth, that is backed up by a lot and growing amounts of evidence here that, growth is very difficult to achieve by, cutting taxes on already profitable, already very well incentivized business owners. You already have extreme incentives to find profit. Our system is very, very good at hunting out those opportunities and finding them. And it's a bit difficult to find, more than like very marginal effects from these tax changes.
One of the arguments for reducing corporate taxes and increasing depreciation allowances is, in fact, and look, at some level it makes sense. If you tell me that I can immediately write off stock, machinery, equipment, things that could create productivity. But if I can immediately write off, that does create an incentive for me to do that.
Yeah.
But what have we seen in the past? I mean, again, going back to what we were just talking about, do we see that the ability to immediately depreciate plant and equipment does lead to increased investment in plant and equipment? And by the way, last time, did we see a lot of stock buybacks?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll separate these two things because they really are two different questions, and the economics is very different on both of them. So cutting the tax rate on profits does not, which is what you're doing when you're cutting the corporate rate, when you are, cutting taxes for pass-through businesses, which is also one of the big changes in the Trump tax cuts. That's what I'm like kind of putting over in the barrel of doesn't really have an effect, or the effects are quite small. Things that do have an effect are sort of changing the incentives within the firms or changing the incentives for investors. And so, cutting or, accelerating depreciation for equipment and for, structures, that will make companies more likely to invest in equipment and structures. And the economic evidence on this is good. These sorts of incentives give the economy a jolt, a boost in the arm, or a boost up. And they're good for, economic growth because they are sort of changing the incentives within a company and they are changing incentives for investors. I'm going to invest in this dynamic, innovative firm that's making investments because it's much cheaper to do so rather than this other firm that's just resting on their laurels, collecting rents, from some sort of past investment. So if you are looking to juice economic growth, I would not do it by, cutting the rate on profits. I would do it by, changing firms' incentive to invest in the economy, to grow, create jobs, and things like that.
So basically invest in yourself as a corporation.
Yeah. And the evidence, you would think everyone would be perfectly incentivized to invest in yourself, but it turns out they're not. And we can squeeze some more juice out of that. And, the bill does try and do that, the OBBBA. The 2017 Trump tax cuts also did some of that. And, it's a shame that, so much less effort is going into that and so much more effort is going into things that don't have any sort of economic backing, like lowering taxes on pass-through businesses. There's really no evidence that that is going to, juice any sort of economic growth. You're cutting taxes on people who get a check for giving a lecture. And that doesn't really increase economic growth. It's just kind of a giveaway.
And then the stock buyback question.
Oh, yeah. We saw huge stock buybacks after we gave companies more money and profits. We saw them pass along those profits to their investors. And, that's sort of what you would expect. They receive this windfall of money that they were going to pay in taxes, paying taxes to reduce the deficit. and, you know, fund the other things that the government does, and said they're just left all this money and they pass it along to their stockholders. And, you know, we saw huge increases in that, you know, post 2017 tax cuts. And now we are, Democrats 2 years or 3 years ago, I suppose, at this point, passed a very small stock buyback tax, which, you know, attempts to, you know, capture some of that money. But, you know, we still see, you know, large and growing stock buybacks in the corporate sector that basically follow, you know, profits.
And they certainly aren't a contributor to growth in any sense of the word.
No, you're just kind of like recycling profits. If they were a contributor to growth, they wouldn't be stock buybacks. They would be investments in, exactly, you know, new business equipment or whatever.
Yeah. Now, we had an economist on last week who told us that the only way to stave off an impending crisis is through cutting spending, that we have a spending crisis, not a taxation crisis. What is your perspective on, obviously, I think almost everybody agrees that the current sort of path we're on in terms of deficits is unsustainable, but nobody seems to agree on how to fix it. I'd like to get your take on what do you see as a way out of this?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's kind of funny to be having that question when, you know, what the Congress just tried was, what if we just keep digging? What if we, in fact, you know, like, increase our digging rate, you know, much, you know, three times as fast? And so, you know, right now, our debt is about as large as the economy as a whole. So, you know, and it's projected to increase over the years. What, you know, Republicans and President Trump decided to do was, what if we do cut spending? That, as I, you know, opened up this call, they cut spending on the poorest Americans by cutting Medicaid and by cutting SNAP food assistance. And yet, even after they cut that spending, they also increased the deficit by $4 to $5 trillion. So if cutting spending was the path to getting the debt under control, then I would say, you know, we wouldn't be in this situation, because, you know, this bill does cut spending, but it also increases the debt. So we are in a worse place even after we cut all that spending. You know, if that spending was being cut as some shared sacrifice where, you know, all Americans sort of have to, you know, tighten their belts, you know, the rich people are gonna, you know, take a bit of a cut, poor people are gonna take a bit of a cut, but we have to do it to, you know, solve the deficit problem, I would understand that. And, you know, perhaps that's sort of how we get out of this. But that's not what this bill does. This bill says poor people have to take it on the chin in order to give rich people a very large extra tax cut. And, oh, by the way, we're going to throw in all these other, you know, unrelated tax cuts for banks, for real estate investment trusts, for distilled spirits manufacturers, for private school vouchers. All these things get tax giveaways in this bill. But, you know, poor people's health care, rural hospitals, you know, rural grocery stores that rely on, you know, the revenue from SNAP food assistance, they're all sort of taking it on the chin so that, you know, they can have these handouts given out to, you know, all these other industries.
We have about 30 seconds. I take it that this bill is likely to increase income and wealth inequality in this country, in your view?
Yes, absolutely. I think, you know, we'll get another score out from the Congressional Budget Office that kind of nets out, you know, who are the winners and who are the losers in the bill. But, you know, as I said, to start this off, you know, their preliminary look at this said that the bottom 30% of Americans are losing out because of the bill. Their after tax and transfer income is going down, whereas, you know, the biggest winners are, you know, the top 10% and the top 1% within them, who are getting, you know, as I said, $68,000 in tax cuts for the top 1%. So, you know, we'll get an updated score on that this week. And I'm, you know, I shouldn't say I'm looking forward to seeing what it says, because I think that it'll be bad for most Americans.
Corey Husek, thanks for spending time with us this morning. We'll be right back after this.